Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, listener mail. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Monday, so we're bringing you some messages that have come into the show mailbox over the past few weeks. Let's see, we are still getting messages about the vegetable lamb of Tartary. People never give up on that one. Let's see.
People love the vegetable lamb. People love it.
They're constantly coming up to us saying, why aren't we getting more vegetable lamb? Rob, do you want to do this one from Ian, or should I take
sure, it? Sure. Dear Robert and Joe, I'm about 6 weeks behind on episodes, so apologies if someone already wrote in about this, but I was listening to your episode on the Lamb of Tartary and was reminded of a group of plants that does grow itself an animal. The Ophrys genus of orchids are known as bee orchids, and each one grows flowers that are little replicas of a female bee or other pollinator. The flowers not only look and feel like the female, but also release the sex hormone of fertile females. This facsimile lures in males to try to mate with the flower, thereby transferring pollen and fertilizing the orchid. Each species of this orchid is adapted to lure in males of only one particular pollinator species, though rarely individuals of a closely related species will be duped as well. Amusingly, males do eventually learn to distinguish between the flowers and true females of their species, so it tends to be the younger, inexperienced males that are tricked. It actually makes me feel a little bad for them. This is obviously a far cry from the fully functioning mammal on a tether of the Lamb of Tartary, but is nonetheless a fascinating example of very specific evolutionary pressures causing a plant to grow a kind of animal on its stem. As always, thanks for your wonderful show, and please keep up the good work. Ian. Well, that is a great example, Ian. And actually, I while we were recording those episodes, or maybe shortly before, I went to the Atlanta Botanical Garden, and I was walking around, like looking particularly at ferns, thinking I might see some sort of woolly mass that resembled a sheep, but also looking at a lot of orchids. And yeah, there's so many fabulous forms in the orchids, some that at least to the human imagination may look like little creatures or little little humanoids, little angels at times. And yeah, this is a great example of a targeted mimicry that is employed by the flower.
Rob, do you know about the orchid that looks kind of like a sinister clown?
I don't know this one.
It looks kind of like the Violator from Spawn or something. So look up Ophrys Ariadne, or the species name is Ariadnae.
Oh yeah, this is interesting looking. I don't know. I don't get as much of a Spawn feel from this. It's more. It looks like some sort of a fluffy winged Pokemon type of creature.
Okay.
But I like it.
I mean, I guess it depends exactly how the pattern works out, and if you squint when you're looking at it and stuff. But I can sometimes see like a mean looking kind of rotund clown that's telling me I'm going to go to hell. I don't know.
I see like a slightly burly little fella with very fuzzy arms or wings. It almost looks like I can see two eyes for sure, and almost kind of like a beak going on there. It's kind of making a Muppet face. Like kind of, you know, when Kermit the Frog is a little perturbed, like that kind of like scrunched in face.
Oh yeah, I know what you're talking about. The kind of when the puppet bends. But the clown orchid is in the same genus, the Ophrys genus.
Oh okay, yeah yeah. Well, it's a remarkable looking specimen. I don't know that I've seen one in person though.
To be clear, I don't think it's officially called the clown orchid. That's just what it looked like to me.
All right. Well, we've got the last of the vegetable lamb listener mail out of the way. What's next on the schedule here? What's next on the plate?
So many listeners got in touch about cauldrons, specifically about our segment on the ceramic cooking cauldrons of the Jomon culture in prehistoric Japan.
Mm.
Now, you remember these were ceramic pots that were used for cooking by these hunter-gatherers who lived in Japan. And these pots had intriguing features. For example, they had decorative textures that were made by pressing ropes into the wet clay. So you see kind of a fibery texture along the outside of the finished pots. But also, a mysterious fact that we discussed was that the earliest pots in this pottery school appear to be rounded on the bottom rather than flat. So these were cooking vessels that would not stand up by themselves on a flat surface.
Hmm.
So on to the messages addressing that. This first one comes from Kat, and she says, just listen to episode 1 of Cauldrons, and I have some clues to throw your way regarding questions you posited in the episode. First, why were the earliest cauldrons rounded rather than flat-bottomed? Speaking as a crafter, I answer for strength. Angles in pottery are weak points and frequent points of failure. Speaking as a cook, I answer for evenness of heating throughout. The same reason why Chinese and Japanese cooking still makes use of the wok. You can get a lot more control of temperature in a rounded vessel. Speaking as someone who has to wash her own dishes, for ease of maintenance. Food scraps don't have corners to cling in after the cooking's done, and so the pot can last longer before the accumulated residue of previous meals begins to be evident in the background flavor. And speaking as someone who backpacks, portability and travel security. You can stick a rounded pot upside down on a backpack's protrusion and be reliably sure it will stay there without needing to be tied down or risking the weak point of some kind of handle. That last point is really interesting, Kat, because, yeah, as we talked about it, you might have expected that pottery was invented by people who had already settled down into a stable, like, fixed existence in geography and started practicing agriculture. But no, the evidence is that the Jomon culture was making pottery for cooking in while they were still hunter-gatherers.
Mm.
Kat continues, also, I would like to know if the upper rims of these really ancient pots have been found or not, because it could well be that they were hung or suspended over fires, as later metal cauldrons came to be, in which case the rounded bottom definitely allows for even heating throughout the contents, as opposed to the scorching that a flat bottom pan gives when hung over fire. This is me speaking as a camp cook, by the way. Next, I want to posit a scenario. A tribe of gatherers makes their seasonal camp on a riverbed in a fertile valley. In the months since they were last there, the river has flooded somewhat, and they discover that the hollow pit where they had made the communal fire they kept going for months at a go last year was sort of washed out by the current. But here's the thing. The clay bottom of the pit, where the coals had sat, that earth is still solid. Hollowed out on one side, but like a rounded rock when someone knocks on it with their knuckles. Now imagine that this happens every year when they come back. A new fire pit in the bottomland clay, a new hollowed out rock where no such rock existed before. Maybe eventually a flood that's a little tamer than the others and only washes out half of the hard-baked clay, and suddenly some woman, for it's reliably the women spending all of their days at these fires after all, works out what happened, and maybe how to do it on purpose, too. In short, my theory is that the first pottery came about as most all human innovations did, just to see if a natural effect could be done deliberately. The uses to which they would put it, I figured that happened later, once the new hardened hollow rock that the first lady crafted came out of the fire intact. Anyway, thanks for your time, for your fascinating research, and for your podcast, Kat.
Very good points, Kat.
Yeah, yeah. I love all the personal experience with camp cooking and stuff as well. I can't remember. Did we talk about the idea that these pots may have been suspended over fires by ropes or fibers or leather straps or something like that?
I don't know if we got into that as much, but certainly when you look back at the early history of this style of cooking, yeah, you're dealing with like even in the period before pottery. Yeah, you're talking about either cooking in the ground or cooking suspended above the fire, et cetera. So very much something to take into account.
Yeah, that does seem like a possibility to me. And that would explain why it could be rounded on the bottom. Or it could be that it sat in some kind of holder.
Mm. All right, this next one comes to us from Sean. Sean writes, "Hi, Joe and Rob. Just finished The Cauldron, Part 1. Episode and had three thoughts. Number one, you mused about the transition from open flame cooking to wet cooking. Perhaps there was a noticeable decrease in sickness and death among those whose liquid was solely or mostly from soup or broth, since boiling would kill microbes in the water. So perhaps it was adopted partially because it seemed to be safer."
That's an interesting idea. And so my brain immediately went to like, well, wait a minute, if you're eating soup, does that necessarily mean you need to drink less water? But then I guess I'm probably thinking about like soup that is salty to a modern canned soup extent. If you're eating like soup, you know, largely liquid based food, soups and broths that are not heavily salted. Yeah, that's probably replacing a huge amount of the need for water you would need to drink otherwise. So yeah, you could be essentially turning your water needs into mostly or entirely cooked water, which would lower the risk of waterborne illness. Yeah.
Plus, I think we touched on, like, you go into the history of tea, for example, and, you know, you go back far enough and the dividing line between drink and soup and broth becomes a little less clear. All right, Sean's point number two. Have you heard of the iron fish? You can read about it on Wikipedia, but essentially impoverished Cambodian women are anemic. Studies were conducted that found adding an iron ingot to the soup increased iron, but it wasn't until the fish shape, supposed to be lucky, was widely adopted. Not exactly rock cooking, but that's where my thoughts went. So I guess the idea here is a piece of iron shaped like a fish that goes into your pot.
Yeah, I looked this up. So this would be a situation where when you're making a soup, you put the iron fish into the pot and it leaches iron into the food, increasing your iron intake. And I haven't looked into this deeply, but just at a glance, it looked like this was useful in helping people whose anemia was related to dietary iron deficiency, but it was not useful in helping people whose anemia had other causes.
It'd be interesting to see if there are any studies out there about making like non-food items or sort of marginally food items animal-shaped and what effect that has on our psychology. Like
animal
I think
crackers,
about the Swedish fish, for example, the red candy that is shaped like a fish does not contain fish. If memory serves, it's actually vegan. But there's something about it being shaped like the fish makes it more okay. If it were just shaped like a coin, I would be less inclined to eat it somehow, and I can't explain why that is.
You are right. I thought surely the Swedish fish contains gelatin, which would not be vegan, but I looked it up. That is, you are right. It is vegan.
Yes. I've known vegans to swear by it. I'll still eat the occasional Swedish fish. All right. And then point number three from Sean. Lastly, Disney's The Black Cauldron does not do justice to the books, but the art is wonderful and the backstory is amazing. You can find lots on YouTube. I went down the rabbit hole over a week or so. Anyway, thanks for the fascinating topics and wide-ranging discussions. Yeah, I've never actually watched The Black Cauldron all the way through, and I can't get the boy interested in it, and I haven't pressed him hard on it because I've always heard this, that it's kind of a lackluster Disney film, even though it does have some cauldron imagery in it, and you have that, the Horned King that plays an important role in it that is a very cool-looking villain.
Yeah, I've never seen it either.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh,
yeah. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes, packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, Ethan says, hello, Rob and Joe. I'm Ethan from Indiana, longtime fan of the show and listen to it almost every day. I was listening to this this week's episode on the cauldron and the topic of stone boiling, and it immediately brought to mind a video I had seen of about traditional nomadic Mongolian food. In this dish called badug, they cut the head off of a goat, gut the organs they don't want, and then fill the inside of the goat with broth, vegetables, and various other soup ingredients through the severed neck of the goat. The final addition is a handful of searing hot stones from a fire that are dropped into the neck, which is then tied off to create a seal. Once tied, they will shave slash skin the body, opening up the neck every now and again to release pressure or to stir the inside. In the episode discussion, stone boiling seemed like such an ancient and bygone day method of cooking, so I found it fascinating that it's still being practiced in some regions and that this archaic method has stood the test of time. And then Ethan provides a link to the video, says, thanks for the fun discussions you've shared, and I look forward to many more. Cheers, Ethan. So Ethan, I checked out this video, and this is really interesting. Yeah, so it appears to be a traditional practice where you would take an animal like a goat, and I think you would remove some of the some or a lot of the meat and sort of trim it up, and then you would place the meat back inside the hide to stew along with the vegetables and the broth and the seasonings and stuff, and you'd seal it up, and then you sort of singe off the outside of the skin, and then you serve it up as a communal meal. You sort of cut it open at a big table with everybody standing around, and I don't know how universal this practice is, but in the video that Ethan shared, there was an interesting thing where when the stew sack is cut open, before eating, all the people fish out the hot stones and they distribute them to the guests, and everybody holds them in their hands, and they must still be pretty hot because they sort of keep tossing the hot stones, tossing them or passing them back and forth from palm to palm. And I can't be certain, but it looks like this is implied to be a regular part of the experience of eating bodug. Like it's part of the meal. You'd feel the stone as a type of culinary experience.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, thanks for writing in, Ethan. All right, here's another cauldron message. This one comes to us from Tyler. Hi, Robert and Joe. After listening to your most recent episode on cauldrons, I was wondering if, in any of the research you have done on Chinese mythology, you have run across the sculpture garden at Ha Par Villa in Singapore. Along with many scriptural dioramas depicting events in Chinese mythology, there is an exhibit depicting many different circles of hell. I had the opportunity to visit Ha Par when I was living in Singapore, and the whole place is very strange and a lot of fun. Here is a link to the site, but you may have better luck getting a feel for the place through an image search. And they do, in fact, include this link, which is hawparvilla.sg. It is a very nice website that, it kind of seems to sort of gloss over the grislier details of the hell exhibit, or at least some of the photos you'll find in an image search. Tyler writes, I have included a couple of photos I took while there. I love the podcast and you guys always do a great job. All the best, Tyler.
One of these photos captures an awesome turtle man. It's like a turtle shell. It's like surfing on a wave, but instead of a turtle's head coming out of the neck hole, it is the upper body of a man.
Nice. It looks like there's some giant crabs in here as well.
Oh, yes.
And then there is looks like there is a large demon with a man on a meat hook or a skewer of some sort, possibly dunking him into some sort of a foul river or vat.
This turtle man, though, does not look like hell imagery. This looks like a blast.
I've never been to this exhibit, so I don't know what part of the exhibit this is a photo from. This may be from part of it that is not connected to the various hells and is tied with some other mythology. But it looks like there are some other sort of aquatic hybrid people in the background as well.
Yeah, this looks great.
So thanks, Tyler, for writing in and sharing these images with us. This is a fascinating place. I think I'd maybe heard of it in the past, but like I say, certainly haven't been there, but it looks amazing.
All All right, let's see. Maybe we do one more about cauldrons. This one from Lee.
Okay.
Lee says, "Hello, Rob and Joe. Just finished listening to the cauldron episode. The episode reminded me of a trick we learned when in the Scouts. Boiling water in a paper cup. A regular paper cup. It can be waxed, but not plastic or styrofoam. Filled with water and placed in a fire and will maintain its integrity while the water boils. We took it one step further and placed an egg in the cup of water before placing it in the fire. The result was one hard-boiled egg. The cup will burn, but only down to the water level." This memory got me thinking about early cooking vessels, as you were talking about them. I have no real support for this, but please follow along. If early buckets for hauling water were made from animal hide, they likely were bowl-shaped, since stitching a flat bottom would result in leaks. Handles to facilitate carrying would likely result in drawstring closure of sorts to the top. Think a marble bag. If these wet water bags were suspended over a fire, the water could be boiled since the wet bag wouldn't burn. The longish carry handles could hold the bag from the tripod or other device and be long enough to keep the handles from the fire. If this design carried over to a vessel made of riverbank clay, it could explain the round bottom of early clay cooking vessels. Again, no proof, just food for thought. Love the show. Look forward to every episode. Lee. That's interesting, Lee. I had no idea that you could boil water in a wet cup. I've never tried it. And I don't know if the same would apply to a piece of hide, but that it seems to make sense that it might, at least, because, I mean, obviously, once you introduce water into a heating equation, you know, that's going to, water just absorbs so much heat. I can see how it would potentially prevent the burning through of a material that might otherwise be burned through pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Now, I have to say, as a former scout and the parent of a current scout, I don't think I have ever conducted this waxed paper cup egg experiment. But I trust the listener's experience here. I'll have to try it myself.
I just looked it up. Can you boil water in a paper cup? The internet seems to be pretty unanimous. Yes, you can. Basically, because the ignition temperature of the paper is going to be higher than the boiling point of the water, so the heat that's going into the wet bottom of the paper cup is just continually heating up the water. I think it would have to evaporate the water before the cup would be able to get hot enough to catch on fire.
Hmm. All right. Well, we appreciate everyone who wrote in about our cauldron episodes, and I'm assuming we'll get some more listener mail related to those episodes, plus the subsequent cauldron episodes. So write in, let us know what you think, what you've experienced, what you've heard. We'd love to hear from you. As a reminder, listener mail episodes run most Mondays, and then on most Wednesdays we do a short form episode that is an artifact or a monster fact. On Tuesdays and Thursdays we do our core episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, and on Fridays we do Weird House Cinema. That's our time to set aside most serious concerns and just talk about a weird film. You'll find it all in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun.
Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.